to welcome Mr. Tate to the Poetry Center and to the campus. James Tate is the one of the youngest poets whose work has been chosen for the Yale Series of Younger Poets last year, 1967. His book, The Lost Pilot, was chosen for this series. In the introduction to the book, Dudley Fitts calls attention to the vigorous freshness of Mr. Tate's invention, to his natural grace, to what he calls a robust, amused, declarative style. He corrects that by also calling it weird and substantial. He speaks of a gaiety, a fresh, unselfconscious way of perceiving and recording. I think all those things are true. I find what I would like simply to add one observation of my own to those. It seems to me what's remarkable about the book is the degree of mastery that James Tate has of a more or less surreal technique used for purposes other than the surreal. It seems to me what Mr. Fitts has in mind when he calls the work weird and substantial, perhaps that's what I have in mind. The technique is weird and exciting and vivid and offbeat. The subject is intense, central, and personal. The technique may be exotic. The subject, I think, is not. It's a great pleasure to give you James Tate.
Well, for obvious reasons, I think I'll begin with a poem called The Day Lost. Just been driving 100 miles an hour for about the last 50 minutes trying to find state. Found the airport for future use. This poem's called The Day Lost. They would go riding through the woods of Tennessee when they were first married. The gloaming greensward seduced their hearts, and they would stop to give their weary steeds refreshment at a mountain spring. Her high brown English boots were winning to his eye, and she adored the party-colored pants he wore. The sun streamed through the leaves to make the trees seem more like chandeliers. It was here he handed her the ring. Her tears flew. She was, quote, at a loss for words. On a silver anniversary in Indiana, she stands in the north corner of the living room in her negligee, snowshoes, and skullcap, and he is dancing on the table in his Macintosh and cummerbund. Both realize how precious life is. To save time, the horses are in the kitchen making soup. I'll read some poems from my book, and then I'll read some poems from a new manuscript. First poem's called Coming Down Cleveland Avenue. The fumes from all kinds of machines have dirtied the snow. You propose to polish it, the miles between home and wherever you and your lily of a woman might go. You go, pale brush and suds, scrubbing down Cleveland Avenue toward the Hartford Life Insurance Company. No one appreciates your effort, and one important character calls you a baboon. But pretty soon, your darling jumps out of an elevator and kisses you, and you sing and tell her to walk the white plains proudly. At one point, you even lay down your coat, and she in turn puts hers down for you. And you put your shirt down, and she her blouse, and your pants, and her skirt, shoes, removes her lavender underwear, and you slip into her proud white skin. That's the end of that poem. The next poem I'll read is called Reapers of the Water. It comes from an experience I had while walking around, hitchhiking through parts of Louisiana far south of New Orleans in the Bayou country. And it's a pretty strange country down there, all right. And the trees are all strangled by the Spanish moss, and they hang down to the ground, and everything's very still most of the time. And then within, you know, 2 minutes, a terrible storm can come in and blow away many of these little shanties, and it's just very strange. And I had the luck to come across a very beautiful scene one day after I'd been down there some time, which was the blessing of a shrimp fleet in Thibodaux, Louisiana. It was pretty strange to find this elaborate ritual going on in just in this very hidden part of the world. The nets newly tarred and the family arranged on deck, mass has started. The archbishop in his golden cope and tall mitre, a resplendent figure against an unwonted background, the darting silver of water, green and lavender of the hyacinths, the slow movement of occasional boats. Incense floats up and about the dripping gray moss, and the sound of the altar bell rings out. Automatically, all who have stayed on their boats drop to their knees with the others on shore. The prelate, next taking up his sermon, recalls that the disciples of Christ were drawn from the fishermen of Galilee. Through the night at the lake, they cast in vain. Then he told them to try once more, and lo, the nets came heavily loaded. Now there will be days when you too will cast your nets without success. Be not discouraged. His all-seeing eye will be on you. And in the storm, when your boat tosses like a thin leaf, hold firm. Who knows whose man will be next? Grand Mère, whose face describes how three of hers, her husband and those two boys, had not returned, now looks toward her last son. It is a matter of time. The prelate dips his gold aspergillum into the container of holy water and lifts it high. As the white and green boats pass, the drops fall on the scrub decks, on the nets, on the shoulders of the nearest ones, and they move up the long waterway. The crowds watching and waving, the Sea Dream, the Normandy, the Barbara Coast, the Little Hot Dog, the God Bless America, the Madam of Kew, racing past the last tendrils of the warm pudding that is Louisiana. Next poem is called The Butcher with Nothing but Bones. You touch the window, certainly it is there. You are having a very good time touching the window, imagining what is hiding behind. There, the regally garmented coquette cautiously drops by, feeling the window pane too, blind to your vigil. She is the good friend, just arrived in the nick of time. What would you give for the right size rock? When wearing the window away with your nose, the window grows. Your lips are finally rocks, and the window keeps growing. She is just fine. She is just being crushed. She is just your kind of girl. This next poem is a narrative poem, and kind of and it begins on a railroad trestle above about 50 feet above a creek, with one character waiting for another, and shortly thereafter the two meet on the trestle, and then a train comes and they're forced to dive into the creek. And that's just the action of it. It's not what it's about. It's called Success Comes to Cow Creek. I sit on the tracks 100 feet from earth, 50 from the water. Gerald is inching toward me as grim, slow, and determined as a season, because he has no trade and wants none. It's been 9 months since I last listened to his fate, but I know what he will say. He's the fire hydrant of the underdog. When he reaches my point above the creek, he sits down without salutation and spits profoundly out past the edge and peeks for meaning in the ripple it brings. He scowls. He speaks. When you walk down any street, you see nothing but coagulations of shit and vomit, and I'm sick of it. I suggest suicide. He prefers murder and spits again for the sake of all the great, devout losers. A conductor's horn concerto breaks the air, and we, two doomed pennies on the track, shove off and somersault like anesthetized fleas, ruffling the ideal locomotive poised on the water with our light, dry bodies. Gerald shouts terrifically as he sails downstream like a young man with a destination. I swim toward shore as fast as my boots will allow, as always, neglecting to drown. Next poem is called The End of the Line. And it makes reference to Hannibal and Carthage, and these are towns in Missouri. We plan in partial sleep a day of intense activity to arrive at a final bargain with the deaf grocer to somehow halt a train. We plan our love's rejuvenation one last time. And then she dreams another life altogether. I've gone away. The petals of a red bud caught in the wind between Hannibal and Carthage. The day has disappeared. Like a little soap bubble, the moon glides around our bed. We are two Negroes, lugubriously sprawled on a parched boardwalk. Next poem is called Flight. It's a kind of it's an escape fantasy. It takes place in one of those god-awful apartment buildings that impoverished students are often forced to live in, where you can hear, you know quite a bit about your neighbor's life. Like a glum cricket, the refrigerator is singing, and just as I am convinced that it is the only noise in the building, a pot falls in 2B. The neighbors on both sides of me suddenly realize that they have not made love to their wives since 1947. The racket multiplies. The man down hall is teaching his dog to fly. The fish are disgusted and beat their heads blue against a cold aquarium. I too lose control and consider the dust huddled in the corner a threat to my endurance. Were you here, we would not tolerate mongrels in the air, nor the conspiracies of dust. We would drive all night, your head tilted on my shoulder. At dawn, I would nudge you with my anxious fingers and say, "Already we're in Idaho." that was written in Iowa, and that has some significance, since anything sounds like paradise in Iowa. Out here, Idaho doesn't sound so good. This next poem is called Grace. The one thing that sustained the faces on the four corners of the intersection did not unite them, did not invite others to join. Their inner eyes, as the light changed, did not change, but focused, madly precise, on the one thing until it scared them. Then they all went to the movies. I was just beginning to understand when one who represented the desperate, shrunken state came toward me, bisecting the whole mass of concrete into triangles, and handed me a package. I carried it with me for the rest of my life, never opening it, telling no one. It's deep. Next poem is called Uncle. Homer was a ventriloquist, so drunk one day he projected his voice so far, it just kept going and going, still is. Joe Ray insisted Homer was afraid of work, but he's had 130 jobs or more just recently. He didn't think in terms of careers. The family never cared for Homer, even after he ginned himself into a wall and died bawling with a deaf mute in an empty Kansas City hall. Joe Ray insisted Homer would have made a fine dentist had he kept his mouth shut, that is, had he lived. Still is heard about the house, jiggling glasses, his devoted astral voice coming back. The only thing that's not true in that poem is the fact that that Homer is still very much alive, and for that reason, my family convinced me to keep that poem unprinted for a while, I guess hoping that that fact might be changed. Yeah. I gave up on him and published it. Next poem is called How the Friends Met. It was written, actually, I guess to or about my very best friend and all my other acquaintances and friends, can't quite understand why I continue this friendship with this guy who has some pretty unattractive habits and qualities. So this is sort of an explanation. It's called How the Friends Met. So what do you do? What can you do? Leave the room altogether? Crazy. Your eyes are the wallpaper. Makes it tough, doesn't it? Peel them away. You call that pain? It's not. It's insane. You make it. Keep going. Confront a light pole. Smoke a mythopoeic cigarette forever. Mark a spot with your mysterious shoe. Scratch hate in the sidewalk. A man will come along and there will be reason enough to knife him. Sure enough, there comes along a worse than Bogart. There you are, smoking the light pole. The spot you marked appears between your eyes and then becomes a sidewalk, and the man walks right up the sidewalk into your room, looks at the wallpaper, and laughs. So what do you do? What can you do? Kick him out? Hell no. You charge him rent. And one last poem from the book, a poem called The Loveliest Woman in Altoona, Iowa. Those of you who haven't been to the Midwest can experience it. Tonight, the loveliest woman in Altoona is giving herself to a dry-cleaning apprentice beneath swings in City Park. His mustard breath, his life, is crystallizing as he manipulates her loins, imagining competence. And then it happens. Her coveted eggs rush through the earth like small, ecstatic animals, and the Midwest contracts in horror. There is hardly a place to stand. The entire village has gathered to confirm the mayor's prediction. Gabriella and Barnaby have come to an evil end. Smoke, water, and sirens malign the sky. Surely it will be broadcast soon that all is under control, and the elders will sigh, thinking they too are under control, though their lives were exposed to a crime of passion. Come see the people writhe. I wanted to I used to try and resist writing poems that had anything to do with poetry or poets or anything like that. And then I stopped resisting it because most poems are essentially, I suppose, about poetry on one level or not. So many of William's poems or Stephen's poems seem to be. Well, these aren't really about poetry. I have three not written at once or not written, you know, necessarily intentionally, but I realize that in the past 8 or 9 months I've written three poems about poets, about different poets. So I think I'll read them. First one's called When Kabir Died, and Kabir was an Indian poet in the 14th century. And only one fact you need know, and that was that he was neither Mohammedan he was neither Muslim nor Hindu, and this was unusual. When Kabir died, they fought over his body. The Mohammedans wanted to bury the remains, while the Hindus desired to burn them. They argued so for days. Then Kabir appeared before them and told them to go to the casket and remove his shroud. Both parties obeyed. They found in place of the corpse a heap of flowers, half of which were taken to Maghar by the Mohammedans and buried, the other half to Benares and burned by the Hindus. As Kabir himself has said, we can reach the goal without crossing the road. Or no, at the heart of the universe, white music is blossoming. Next one is called Failed Tribute to the Stonemason of Torhouse, Robinson Jeffers. As many of you probably know, Jeffers discovered Carmel for himself, I don't know when, 1909 or so, and changed his whole life quite a bit, and he decided to build a house. And first he contracted some people to build it, and then he and his wife were thinking, well, maybe, you know, I don't know if we trust them or not. So Jefferson had never done any labor in his life, but his wife suggested that maybe he should try and get a job with the contractor and help build the house. So he did. He got a job cutting stone as an apprentice, a stonemason. And then when they finished this little section, they finished what was the first part of the house, or what was the house at that point, and they were dismissed. Jeffers went on building for years and years. Building, he built the tower for, you know, and other parts of the house. So anyway, so I'd been reading about Jeffers and reading Jeffers, and finally got together and went down to look at the place. And well, okay, I won't explain anymore. It's Carmel's not what it used to be. I hadn't been there before. It's called Failed Tribute to the Stonemason of Torhouse, Robinson Jeffers. We traveled down to see your house, Torhouse, Hawks Tower, in Carmel, California. It was not quite what I thought it would be. I wanted it to be on a hill with a view of the ocean unobstructed by other dwellings. 50 years ago, I know you had a clean walk to the sea, hopping from boulder to boulder, the various sea fowl rightly impressed with your lean, stern face. But today, with our cameras cocked, we had to sneak and crawl through trimmed lawns to even verify the identity of your strange carbuncular creation, now rented to trillionaire non-literary folk from Pasadena. Edged in on all sides by tri-level pasteboard phantasms, it took a pair of good glasses to barely see some newlyweds feed popcorn to an albatross. Man is a puny thing, divorced whether he knows it or not, and pays his monthly alimony, his child support. Year after year, you strolled down to this exceptionally violent shore and chose your boulder. The arms grew as the house grew, as the mind grew, to exist outside of time, beyond the dalliance of your fellows. Today, I hate Carmel. I seek libation in the tiki bar. Naked native ladies are painted in iridescent orange on velvet cloth. The whole town loves art. And I donate this Singapore sling to the memory of it, and join the stream of idlers simmering outside. Much as hawks circled your head when you cut stone all afternoon, kids with funny hats on motor scooters keep circling the block. Jeffers, this trip is a flop. And the next one of these three I said I would read. It's called Conjuring Rutke. I actually hadn't been reading Rutke for quite a while when I wrote this, and the poem is one of those that happen, you know, maybe once a year, that was, I guess, composed in a dream. And I finally forced myself up and thought I'd try see if I could get some of it on paper, and sure enough, it was still there. And I was in the dream, I was conjuring Rutke, and he came back. I managed to conjure. But you'll recognize the style of poem. As I say, I hadn't been reading Rutke for about a year, but the style is actually similar to that of a series of poems he wrote called Praise to the End. And it's a good style for conjuring because, according to Aleister Crowley, one should conjure in a language one does not understand. Prickle a lamb, giggle a yam, beat a chrysanthemum out of its head with a red feather. Dream of a pencil or three airmail stamps under your pillow. Thank the good fairy, you're not dead. The heat's on, the window's gone, the ceiling is sorry it hurt you. But this is not air holding your hand, nor weasels beneath your dirt rug. I think the corks are out of breath. The bottles begin laughing a zoo. I wish you were here. The calendar is red. A candle closes the room. If this is the life we are all leaving, it's half as bad. Hello again, mad turnip. Let's tango together down to the clear, glad river. Well, if you aren't too restless, I'll read a few more. This is a love poem called The Coming Out of Ourselves Party. You wanted to be strong. I wanted to congratulate all of us on giving in. Gum wrappers are wriggling in the sun. Mrs. Mendoza's voice rattles around Jefferson Street 2 times, an end spinning like a BB in a can. Then I thought of all the women I had ever had. I appreciate the patronage. Thanks for dropping in. But the king relinquishes his zither. We were last together at the Colonial Inn in Concord, Massachusetts. We had a free television. We were allowed to park without charge and given a direct dial telephone. 60 air-conditioned rooms, including the Thoreau Room, the Emerson Bar, and the Hawthorne John. You wanted to have integrity. What a day, the clerk said. The sky is disheveling overhead. The pulse of the earth is slowing. On this street, there is not even a radio. The days continue to eat each other. The doors grow little and thick. Always, finally, we are untouched. This was to be the coming out of ourselves party to which we had all looked forward. This was to be bigger than life. This, the inside story. Poem called The Sisters of Charity, which is in order. I was wrecked on the steps of the convent, noon of a 3-day flight, my stunned head locked inside a 30-gallon bottle. The dark merry birds squirmed in a wobbly loss of precedence. How will he ever get it out? And I replied, such small faith, sisters. Look, it is out. I seem to be reading lighter poems. As long as I'm doing that, I'm going to read this other light one too, a little one called Cloud Marauder. He is the Cloud Marauder, whatever that means. He said he was, and if it's less than true, what else could he be? He said he was the Cloud Marauder, marauds clouds. It's good enough for me. All right. I feel guilty if I read too many light ones, so I'll finish reading with 4 that I consider more serious. First one would be a poem called Peddler. Please do not steal my flowers. They are my last love. I am immune to everything but flowers. The pageantry of most encounters is not quite as exciting as the pollinating pasque flower. It's like a river washing itself over and over. And when the pretty waitress, Lillian, of French descent, walks over a grate in the sidewalk and a gush of hot air slams her dress over her ears, I do not enjoy the view as much as that of flocks blooming. I regard human beings as signals and therefore bow my head to hide my silly grin at the raucous world, a monkey hanging by its tail from an intensely white cliff. That's why we hold out our hands all day, all life, to catch something like that. And night letters, the urgent 100 syllables by which we express less than the minimal Aristotelian tragedy. An ash to swallow every morning with my cereal, a dictionary of stones in the evergreen. In the distance, the man who is in charge of beating children hangs his hands on my cart, and I sprinkle pollen of goldenrod on his open wounds. These are ordinary obligations. But flowers, flowers, there are so many colors, more than there were in poor Joseph's coat, I think. Next one's called Camping in the Valley. Here is a place for my gun. I need everything less and less, have you noticed? But I feel something. Almost anything is having some effect on me. I think I believe what I'm saying. Are you having a little trouble keeping up, dear? Now I am ready to survive, though I suppose we are in danger, sitting here, arms crossed, in the valley, with the black pig on the spit, our little doggie. I have faith the air will soon cohere or speak. Tomorrow morning, as you are pulling on your boots, my love, by the fire. I can't see what the blue mosses are doing now, dripping from the bridge, I'd guess. The toads beneath travel home through the sprung doors of the river. On either side of myself, the water is seldom so navigable. Yes, it behooves us to close our eyelids again. The cold front, the rain, the sun rising around 5:17. An important mission in the morning. What was it? The juniper berries? The death we thought we left in the mountains like a child? Okay, two final poems. This one's called Scenario for Revolutionaries. The wooden key in a stone hand, tigers turning down alleys in waves, huge nervous shapes looming over a still victim, prick the air with claws. Rolling up hills where small men and women are arguing in a row of blue houses, or curl around the legs of a girl running to catch a bus, penetrate the coat of an icy man, cudgel a stop sign. Fog under the automobile accident unfolds like an electric blanket. It slows down life for a moment. Then the knives, guns, and chains are delivered. Shining, they are as beautiful as baby spoons. The unknown mouth of death flashes in a water-filled cave, a gigantic orange wound that never heals and is constantly churning. Brown mice scuttle like soft, flexible jeeps out of the pine trees in the dark beside the road which bled. The subtle lapping sounds, which sound like a rocking wash basin, but is the placenta of the north, registering the stirrings of the infant Paul Bunyan. Then we hesitantly slay the daughters of the daughters of the DAR, whose flag is made of old veins. Seeking our fullness, we are those who suffer toward eternity with a marble eye, the insect of sleep gone forever. Last poem I'll read is called Little Yellow Leaf. A woman's pink body could be preserved, separate from the mass and the mill. An anonymous, though urgent love, capable of disassembling the rest of us like a pure white puzzle or an essay fraught with hyphens. Preserved forever inside a glacier, she moves across the valley like a violin. Our gladness flares like a pheasant in an empty field. One untidy tenderfoot in awe lets his almanac glide through the vestibule. The old chaperone flips his rumpled lariat, but misses it. How strong the need to comprehend the little lights and bells inside our heads when she slides by. Even poor whiskey becomes popular and is gone. Avalanches will begin soon and maybe flood the town below. I think I know her name. Her name is Little Yellow Leaf. I should not let the others know. An owl walks across the trembling floor. She is deathless dream, She holds loose and spare parts of lost lives together with one slender revolving finger. And if she should, for any reason, remove it, everything will stop, and we will know at last our own true names. Speaking them, we will possess nothing more, so great will be the pride or shame. The world needs a love it cannot buy or chain. Untouchable little yellow leaf, lure us beyond loss and gain. Let profit be the love we part with, and failure the first day of the rest of our lives. Thank you.